If you want to take part in the Christmas card stream, now is the last chance for your card to arrive in time. Don't delay.
Understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2025. I'm now here with, I should say that the Distributist is now going to appear on a different night, and tonight it will be Ailp Templar. So you can have a look at the schedule to confirm those slots. That's a problem that's been solved. Anyway, I'm now here with Mark Houghton. Mark Houghton is a figure that will be known to some of you and perhaps not to others. So Mark, welcome to Millennial. This is your first time appearing, another debut. And could you introduce yourself to the audience?
I certainly can. My name is Mark Houghton. For those of you who have been around the political sphere for a while and are familiar in particular with the academic agents sphere of people, I suppose, I am one of the original cast members of Unpopular Opinions, the weekly show, which it no longer is, that was on his channel, and also the long-suffering host of Fake Accents Unite, the podcast on my own channel, which ran for something like 120 episodes. And yeah, I'm also known for being heavily connected with the Basket Weavers organization, which I heavily support and would promote to you, and we'll talk about that later tonight. I've also appeared on The Lotus Eaters. I'm good friends with Carl Benjamin. And other than that, I suppose just Internet Denizen 101 appearing around the space. So commenting on various bits and pieces. I also work with a company called Vox Populi Media, who do more in the field type things, you know, reporting on protests, seeing what the state of Britain is, and so on. That's me.
Yeah, I think it's important to say that you're not only a commentator, you're also quite a practical thinker here, because you've done something. You came up with an idea that with the Basket Weavers and just IRL organizing that I think we need a lot more of, and I've always thought we need a lot more of. And so I'm glad that you came along and did that. All right, so let's get to an introduction to the state of Britain today. That was what you said you'd like to talk about. I think it's, to me, this has been a very full year, and numerous things have happened that I think have really moved the needle. You could say shifted the Overton window. Some people dislike that concept. I guess we can get into that. But either way, yeah, it seems to me that things are going in our direction, and yet we're nearly halfway through the interviews on Millennial this year, and not many people are talking about the events of this year, and I'm rather disappointed. What would you say about 2025 and the general state of Britain? And I guess you can comment on the Overton window concept as well.
Well, if we start as we mean to go on, I mean, I'm a big proponent of elite theory, which I know is going to immediately turn a number of people off, and they're going to cringe and go, oh, and there's one of these guys who thinks that nothing can ever be achieved anywhere. And that's not what I'm saying. When it comes to the Overton window, the Overton window is more of a concept of a snapshot of what does the political diaspora of a country, in our case, or any particular group look like. So it's a useful tool in that you can determine the direction of travel, but as to who is directing that direction of travel, how we arrive there, what set of events sort of set that in motion, is a different question entirely. And I think it's not just the movement of elites. I think it is also the movement of events, and not all events are predicted or controlled or orchestrated, shall we say, by those groups. Some things are inevitable, some things are inherited by different groups, some things are essentially we're put on a trajectory, right? So, for instance, we know that our financial system in the UK is heading towards ruin in its own way. If you look at the rate of inflation, if you look at the quantitative easing problem that we have, infinite money printer go brr and stuff like that. If you look at the number of financial crashes that we've had over time and the solutions which people are proposing to solve the fact that we are spiraling into ever more debt, then due to the Keynesian experiment, then basically there are going to be fallouts from the fact that we've been living under a Keynesian economic model for the past sort of 20, 30 years, that, you know, you could even push it back to the 1970s if you want to go back to the gold standard stuff for America. That puts us in a position where we inherit a cascading series of problems, basically. So for 2025, specifically, we find ourselves in a really peculiar place where things seem to be falling out of the hands of the status quo. They're falling out of the Overton window, if you want to say, is shifting in our direction, because it inevitably has to, because we've lived under this lie that, one, we can infinitely print money, that, two, we can collapse our entire manufacturing sector and send it to the third world and cheaper places to manufacture it. We can destroy our skills-based industry and our education system, and then at the end of that all, still maintain a service-based economy that isn't just the City of London profiting massively off things and the rest of us sort of being left behind. And 2025 is where we're starting to see the inevitable outcomes of all of that kind of rear its ugly head in a way which is unavoidable. So we see that inflation is really high. We see the product of mass immigration, which was used to shore up the pension system. Not, maybe people don't necessarily know this. It's not just about rubbing the right nose in diversity. It's not just about making an ideological point, although that is not something which should be ignored. But it is about the propping up of a system which they can see is a pyramid scheme and is inevitably going to fail because the birth rate slowed down. And they can't conceive of a future where there's sort of like a homeostasis, if you will, for the country's population. So they go, oh, you know, we'll put in place a system where we have 45 million British people, specifically the English, Welsh, Scottish, and Northern Irish, and that number doesn't really go up. So there's no real system in place for that. Or rather, there's no political will for a system which would provide a healthy level of social safety net to the elderly, who are burgeoning, obviously, compared to the burden on the youth. I appreciate I'm going on at length here and rambling a little bit, but to get back to...
No, that's absolutely fine. Don't worry about it. You're very cogent.
But to go back to the events of 2025 specifically, there have been events this year which I think... the word from Merriam-Webster this year has been slop. I would propose a kind of counter to that and say there's a second word, which in particular has been very relevant amongst our circles, and that's fatigue. So we have a constant supply of, like, Afghans, for instance, constantly raping and murdering people. It feels like there's one every single day, at least two or three a week. There are particular patterns in media reporting that have been highlighted again and again and again. We've seen the rise of citizen journalism. And whenever you think of citizen journalism in terms of its efficacy, we have more eyes and more searching eyes than ever before on the topics which are of interest to people on the right. Whereas before it was something like, you have to brown nose your way up the BBC for 25 years, And then you might get into a producing position where you might be able to get Adam Curtis to produce a documentary on something adjacent to adjacent to the topic you're actually interested in a little bit too late. Whereas now, or submit a Freedom of Information request and get filibustered and blown off by the establishment. Whereas now you have a deluge of like 1,000 people, say, who are highly motivated submitting those Freedom of Information requests and then sort of piecing all the information together from 12 rejections and going, oh, well, this is what the story looks like. And so we can form a better view of the country than ever before, I think, due to the nature of this. Things like the protests in Epping around the migrant hotel fiasco, basically. That's been a huge thing this year, where people are just facing the inevitable consequences of our open border policy, where instead of doing the sensible thing, which is deploying the Navy and sinking a single boat and then everyone else going, it's not a great idea to cross the channel illegally. We end up in a situation where we're putting them up at huge financial cost. There's something like £550 million a year or something like that just on the hotels themselves. That's to say nothing of any other benefits they may receive. And so on, £1 billion a month in like foreigner benefits and social housing, which is to say nothing of second order effects like the cost of social housing in general, house prices anywhere, the fact that we're overpopulated, one of the densest populated countries in the world, despite being, and that's below countries which are tiny, you know, like the Netherlands and things like that, where there's a lot less space. And we're just accepted to lump it. We've seen the generational divide grow over 2025. Obviously, emblematic in, let's say, something like Fuentes versus Morgan in its interview, but also in the kinds of people who are saying, look, there's this huge people like Charlie Downs and so on, and the Restore Britain movement, where Zoomers are basically standing up and some of the millennials as well, I would hope, and saying, look, like, this is too much, this is enough, everything's so expensive.
Another example of that is Connor Tomlinson versus Michael Gove, that little disagreement, which really spiraled and became, because Connor Tomlinson is very good at this. He made a stink about it, and I think that worked as well as actually getting the footage released. This was about a debate that he did with Michael Gove and I think some other participant that I can't remember now. I think it was Catherine Barbalsing. And Michael Gove works for The Spectator, and The Spectator disallowed this footage from being released and broadcast. So, and Connor Tomlinson raised a stink about that. And I think that worked very well for him. But again, it's just adding into this generational thing where you've got older people trying to silence and stymie younger men who are complaining about the way the world actually is today.
Well, even then, there's, if you look back to Connor, who I believe has become slowly more radical over the course of this year in particular, but even back when he was pally with Reform, he was able to go in and add enough of a clout to sit on a panel for Reform. And I said, well, what's the one thing missing from Reform's manifesto at the conference? And he said, oh, remigration or something to that effect. And he's like, there's cheers from the crowd. Now, I think he's over-egging, I think, the response that he got to that, possibly, although it's unclear from the recording. Perhaps the crowd recording is not as clear. But what's important is, like, that's what's on people's minds, right? In that, and I do want to make it clear that it's really difficult to distinguish between the events of the hyper-reality, which is another word which has come into common parlance this year, which would be all the events that we see online, everything that's in the media cycle, everything that's in the news cycle. The things that they want you to focus on, the things we call containment, the things that we want to actually focus on, the things that we think are important, and how entrenched they are in the cultural zeitgeist for the normal person, the normie. These things are really important to delineate. You know, every so often I'll take a week off and basically just walk around my town and chat to people, quite social, and just see how they feel. I attend a local church, for instance, and I will just have a chat with people, and they still have Trump derangement syndrome, and they still have confusion over a lot of things. And you have to remind yourself as well that we are in a niche and we're very politically engaged, and half the population is under 100 IQ, and there are all these different factors at play that make judging the social case for a given issue's relevance difficult. But I do think that the axiom which says if you're responding, you're losing, is true. And so what has been forced to happen this year, because they think Nigel Farage is all these things, fascist, evil, like going to banish every brown person from the country as soon as he gets in, you know, they've had to, even if he's been bad at responding to those accusations on him, that's the conversation now, is not who's the most racist, you know, why are you being racist? It's how many people should we deport, actually? It's what's an appropriate number? What are the appropriate methods? What's the way we can do this with the least political friction? You know, is it just illegals, or is there a case for legals at all? You know, that sort of direction that's going at the same time. And I disagree with my colleague, academic agent, to an extent on the impact for the normal person of protest. I think if it's large enough, the protest imprints itself on the mind as something that's going on for the normie. Again, being an elite theory guy, it's only when a group of former normals, if you want to call them that, get together with enough wealth and enough resources and enough will and enough connections and decide to make something a go of it, essentially, that things actually start moving. But in terms of what the electorate's expectations are for what they expect from their politicians and stuff like that, I do think protests can indicate several things to us. One of which is, for instance, Tommy Robinson's Unite the Kingdom march, which happened this year, where despite the numbers being disputed, I mean, I was there. I'd say I was reporting on it, to be clear, not necessarily an enthusiastic taking part of Unite the Kingdom, but reporting on it, you can see that there's at least 250,000 people there, pretty reasonably at the peak, you know, probably settling down to somewhere between 100,000 and 200,000, because you can't fit that many people on Whitehall, and the people who couldn't fit on Whitehall went home or buggered off fairly quickly. That aside, you can see that there's a kind of consciousness, which in the UK has typically always been class consciousness, and that shift was not class consciousness in the commie sort of way, but an ethnic consciousness of this is England. And we saw this manifested as well in the flag protests and stuff like that, you know, the Raise the Colours stuff. And the Raise the Colours protest, which as far as I can see has had zero impact on anything in the actual political spectrum, right? It's been a great show. It's been very entertaining. But in terms of its actual impact on the political strata, I think it's been something easy for politicians to demean and denounce. It's been something for the BBC to throw out headlines about how much it's cost to remove all of these dangerous flags, which are going to fall off bridges and blind drivers and stuff like that. You know, £60,000 spent on removing flags in one county or whatever. And but what it indicates is that it's not that the lion is waking up or anything so dramatic, but there's a sense, in the more moderate sense, of the flag, what the flag represents, which is collective us, is now more in the forefront of people's minds. And so they're going to be deciding what that collective us is. There are some people who are on the extreme sort of one side of, not the extreme right, just more like the extreme side of one section, which is like all white people, all Europeans, sort of more broad brush, all white people, have a kind of shared existence, a kind of shared identity. And that needs to be protected. And look, the migrant hordes, which have been assaulting us since about 2015, sort of a migrant crisis there, have all sort of bound us together in the same fate. Our population share of the globe has gone down from like a third to 8.5% or something like that in the last 70 years. So now would be the time. Look what happened to Rhodesia. Let's not let that happen to Europe as a whole, that sort of thing. And then on the other side, you've got people like me who are not civic nationalists, but who are more granular, who go, wait a second, we were at war with the French for how many years? We've got a kind of English ethnic consciousness which needs to come to the front first before you start talking about who we're allied with, because our sense of self is so far gone that the idea that we have these ethnic tensions even within the powers in Europe is completely dissolved. Like, people are aware that we fought the Germans, but the idea that we would, like, we could get into a war with the Germans today is sort of like, and that's an insane thought. It's never crossed any sort of Gen X's mind, or similarly the French, or anything else. It's funny watching political satire from now, like Have I Got News For You, because it's all panel shows and that crap today, and about how they view the faceless bureaucracy of the EU versus something like Yes Minister, which is an old British TV show, which has it is a fiction, but famously supposedly very accurate to how the civil service works, where they're talking about how they entered the EU to destroy it because of Britain's influence was too important to maintain, and how we view about the Germans and the Italians and the French and so on. And so I'm of the opinion that there needs to be a rise and an understanding. The first thing we need to assess it within ourselves is we've got this British identity. We are the English, the Welsh, the Irish, or the Northern Irish, certainly, and the Scots. And we have these tensions. The Scots see the English as very different to themselves. They see themselves as distinct, the Welsh the same. And the English have lost themselves somewhere along the way. So I would like to see the resurgence of the English, and then an understanding then of our relations with our neighbours and how we're going to make that work. And because the Scots obviously agitating for independence over the years and things like that, like, we need to shore up our own borders and shore up our own identity first, and then identify, okay, well, who's an ally in Europe and who's not. There's been a huge furore that I've seen because in the last couple of weeks, all the Poles have been going home, right? All the Poles, because England's a bit of a shithole now, and the Poles are returning home, shall we say, and going, actually, things are a bit better now. The wealth inequality is not the same as it was. You know, I'm not getting so much money here compared to what I'd get at home. In fact, I did see one study, although it's not been, I've not looked at it in any great detail, which suggests that the per capita standard of living for Poland is going to be better than the UK in about 5 to 7 years, right? If trajectory continues the way it is. And that was a curious moment for me, because I was like, right, well, we brought these people over, and I remember distinctly that before the brown hordes sort of arrived, the opinion, shall we say, of the Polish was quite low in this country. You know, like, they were seen as undercutting wages anyway. They would struggle to integrate and struggle to speak English. Now that we've had third worlders who are demonstrably worse, the Poles are now saintly, and we're always here for our benefit and so on. I can see you wanting to say something, so I'll let you.
There's a meme that perfectly illustrates what you're talking about. Let me just see if I can find it. I agree. In retrospect, it seems almost naive and innocent that people were were alarmed by Eastern European migration in the mid-2000s. But of course, it shows how good we had it, that we could be. But of course, it does give you perspective once foreigners arrive from farther afield. Here is the meme.
Yes, we're more similar than previously. Believe me, I've seen this one. The polls. It's a curious one because, again, when I advocate for a bit more granularity than purely just white as a signifier, I am going off of the response that I got. So I said, first of all, remittances from the Poles back to Poland were bad for Britain specifically. They might have been good for Europe, I don't know, but they were bad for Britain because they funneled money out of our economy and into another economy. We have many struggling towns and cities that basically are suffering because a huge amount of the capital that would be internally circulating in our economy is now abroad. This is why the seaside towns are dying, and that's not because of the Poles specifically, but also because of the pensioners who move abroad. You know, we talk about this mass wealth transfer that's going to come from the boomer generation to the Gen Xers and then cascade down. But many of them moved abroad. Many of them are now expats, as we call them. And we know that that's just a signifier for an immigrant living in a little British commune in Spain or Portugal or wherever. But they're spending their money there. They enrich the money there to the tune of many, you know, millions of pounds, I'm sure, that are then never coming back, right? Because even if someone fritters, let's say someone over here inherits £1 million, you know, we're going to ignore inheritance tax for now. If you inherit £1 million, well, the data tells us that within two generations, that money is either frittered or is usually frittered away, right? Usually people are back to rock bottom or having to build themselves back up again. It's very rare that you have a family that instantiates a generational attitude to wealth. So that money is frittered away. But if it's frittered away here, then it's still within the British economy. And so our per capita income and earnings stay up because that's a wealth transfer we can get behind if someone spent money here. But when we move our entire manufacturing industry abroad, when we then spend all of our retirement money abroad, when we bring in the workers from abroad and then they send their wages home instead of spending it in the local shops or wherever it happens to be, or it could even be in the digital economy that was based in the UK if we had looked at seriously at setting up any kind of situation to advantage British digital shops, storefronts, so to speak, as opposed to funneling money to America via Shopify or some weird place in China, the Temu or whatever. All of that money is just leaving the country. And so we go, oh, well, why is the... It's not just that we're spending all this money on foreigners. It's that we're hemorrhaging money out of the country in so many ways. You know, obviously, I've not touched at all on cultural clashes or anything like that at this stage or anything beyond the economic. But I think that's a huge thing that we have to contend with, which is that we keep expecting this big wealth transfer from the upper generations, which I don't think is necessarily coming. I think it's going to be much less than we expect. And so when people go, okay, now we're really dependent on the state pension and the state is already taking 50 pence out of every pound that I earn, what am I going to do now? What are we going to do now? Like, we're facing an unbearable reality of basically really tough decisions. Things are going to be really difficult. Again, the saving grace and I suppose the promise of elite theory, the joy of it in the end, is that power does what power will. And so if we can get our guys into a position of power, either because a new counter elite of our guys has come in and washed away the old, or if because the old has collapsed under its own bureaucratic weight and the fact that it's so opposed to truth and the real way of living and everything that's right and reasonable in this world, that it's collapsed and is completely untenable and someone has had to come in, you know, they'll accept any kind of hardship because things have got so difficult, you know, which is sort of what the accelerationists think they're doing. then you know, we'll be in a position where they'll do what they want, and we'll like some of it, and we won't like some other of it, but it'll at least be still trending in the same direction. I don't know if you want to pick me on any of these things I've said.
Well, you've touched on an awful lot there. Well, there are several things. The first you mentioned, the raise the colours protest, and I'm glad that you mentioned that. I'm glad that somebody has mentioned that, because I thought that I've got to say, especially from academic agent, I thought that got an unfair reception from our guys. Because as far as I could tell, it was genuine, it was authentic. And the guy who started it got in touch with me and explained. And there was a mutual friend who'd known him for years, and I've known that guy for years. So I think it was authentic, at least in its beginnings. And I'm sure it's sloppified. It got taken up by Ezra Levant or whoever. I can't remember now. And yeah, sort of derailed. But I think at its core, it was a sincere ethnic awareness, a call for ethnic awareness from the native English. And I think it was sincere and authentic. Whether it had any effect on politics, I don't think it did, but I think it had an effect on momentum in the same way that any protest does. Because it teaches people the lesson that we can do things. It teaches people the lesson that they do have agency, rather than the opposite lesson, which is we don't have agency and there's no point doing anything. We should just feel powerless because we are powerless. And I think that's a dreadful lesson for the public or any group to learn. And so even if they undertake a project that doesn't have tangible effects but does increase morale, I think that alone is a good enough reason to do it.
I think that there's sort of three things to draw out from what you just said. And the first is one thing which I keep an eye on, which is what's the consequences of this? Direct consequences for the people involved, not the people who are retweeting it or engaging in the surrogate activity online or whatever. But for instance, the chaps, the working class lads who are filmed by Karen on a high street putting up a flag, right? You know, what happens to them? What's the direct impact? Because we've seen the state can be very, very heavy-handed. The second point being that the Southport riots, for instance. Now, obviously, those weren't proper riots, but certainly locals in the direct aftermath of that got rowdy. And the protests that happened there felt the full boot of the law. 24-hour courts, we're going to get you into our overcrowded prison system, we'll let out some murderers and rapists who will offend in 7 days to make room for you. People like Peter Lynch, was it, who died in prison because of the stress of everything, had a heart attack or something in there as well. And you go, okay, so if in response to the Raise the Colours protest, we'd seen similar stuff like that, similar stuff to the Southport riots, then that would have been an interesting point. It always sets the bounds of what you can and can't do under the auspices of the state. It's like when you're talking about the dialectic, if you're talking in a dissident space, you can stay ahead of the talking points of the mainstream. If you can stay ahead of the language that the mainstream associates with the latest big bad, you know, whatever it is, then you can get away with a lot more. You can talk a lot more deeply about stuff, I would say, rather than get away with it, because obviously they're looking to curtail speech. But if your thought process is already three steps ahead of them, you know, and that's always fun, because you get to see years later, suddenly the public, when you talk about the direction of travel being our way, a few years later, you see what we were talking about in like 2017 or whatever coming up, you know, and then they start to police that. But we've already moved on from that, and we're talking about what's next to come or whatever. But to go back, you go, what's the response to an event like Raise the Colours? Is it something as punitive and as harsh as the Southport stuff? Or is it something which is a lighter touch? And so we saw a lot of fines. I'm sure there are some people who were damaged by the amount, you know, criminal prosecutions for public damages and stuff like that. But they basically tried to sweep it away. Things like the Epping protests and the migrant hotel protests, they've been a bit more aggressive on. One of my colleagues, a chap called James Harvey, who's an optimistic young journalist, bless him if he's watching, love you to pieces, James, but he's been he was arrested for a fray and chanting basically outside. He was accused of saying the phrase foreign filth in a chant outside a migrant hotel, not at Epping, but at a different place. And the CPS, the Crown Prosecution Service, have tried to prosecute him three times as a result of this particular charge. And every single time they've been so, like heavy-handed, but also incompetent, that he's had his legal fees had to be paid for. In some cases, he's incurred like £15,000 worth of legal fees and charges and costs and travel and all of the headache that goes with it. And a part of that is that the process itself is a punishment. He's obviously fortunate that we've been able to fundraise for him to support his campaign. But in general, away from the specifics of that, I can see people who are being prosecuted quietly, right? And quietly is an interesting point as well, because it means, again, Southport, here are the people, the nasty racists. We're going to dangle them in front of your face on the evening news. We're going to make sure that you never do this again. Starmer's going to give himself a big speech. Those people who are complaining about the local neighborhood racist, who turns out to be not so local after all, are being quietly dealt with. In the same way they go, we're going to close all those migrant hotels, guys. We're going to close them all. That's the big headline, because they've got to appease now. They're responding to the fact that there was unrest. They're responding, so they're losing. We're going to deal with this, guys. We're moving them all out of the hotels. We're also moving them into military bases, but don't tell anyone that, right? We're going to be quiet. And then, obviously, that's kicked off. Crowborough have said, wait a second, what are you doing? We've got this old disused army camp, and you're going to put 500 young men from abroad there, and our town is 20,000, so that's actually a huge impact on us, for instance. So the three things: what's the impact on as a direct result of any given action, say Raise the Colours? Second, how does that weigh up to previous events that have been either harder or softer hit, and therefore, like, what can we get away with in the future? What can we achieve in the future as a result? So for instance, I'll end it there. I could go on.
yeah. I'm not saying that it was efficacious. I'm just saying that it was authentic, at least before it got sloppified. But first of all, someone pointed out in the chat, it shows everyone else that they're not alone. If people are doing this, everyone else knows. They can see it, and they know that they're not alone in their beliefs. That's one thing. But also, it forced the British state to be seen taking down the national flag. And I think, again, it's not a concrete, tangible result. It doesn't have an effect, but it does have a metapolitical effect. For the British state to be seen doing that, and at great expense, and vindictively, but very thoroughly, it sends a message to anyone who's in any doubt about where their state stands relative to them. And also another thing that was interesting was how it forced let's say the newcomers to admit we don't like the spectacle of the English flag. the British flag, the Union Jack, or whatever.
Uncomfortable, yes.
Yeah, makes us uncomfortable. And the thing is, I can understand that. A lot of folk will say, "Oh, that's preposterous." No, it's not. They know that that does by definition exclude them, and so it brings to the, because it does, because they don't belong here. They've been here 5 minutes. Of course they're not British. Of course they're not English. Of course that flag isn't theirs. So of course it makes them feel excluded. But that's the point. It brings to the fore a fact that has been suppressed and denied, which is fundamentally that these people do not belong here. And the fact that they feel threatened by the flag is not so much a political problem. It's not because of a political thing. It's because of an identity thing. It's not that people are being racist to them. It's that they simply don't belong here. And I think that when they object to the flag and say that they object to the flag, what they're pointing to is not a political problem, but a permanent problem. As long as they're here, they are going to feel that they don't belong, as long as we are here as well.
It depends on... Again, there's a question of numbers and there's a question of where from. So obviously there are people from particular backgrounds who feel much more uncomfortable than others. And so, for instance, the Pakistani nurses who complained that they felt unsafe going to work because they saw an English flag out in their street in West London is a huge issue for us. I did think that it was good, as you say, highlighting that there's this shared identity, but also the alienation of the English from our capital city is huge, because I don't want to give up London. Like, the fact that London is currently occupied doesn't make me want to give it up. I want to take it back, you know, in whatever way. But you have to make people realize that that's something which is going on. In the same way that with the Christians in this country who focus a lot of their activism for Christianity abroad, there's a lot of missionary work still in Africa and China and far away. And Nigeria, for instance, has obviously been huge in the news this year for treatment of Christians. And so there's a lot of Christian focus there. But when you talk to them about the fact that, like, everything's going down the toilet in Britain and the church is basically dead in Britain, and you've got aging populations of people who... there's no revival of the Christian faith, but there is a ramping up of the Islamic faith. And it doesn't matter that at the moment they go, "Oh, it's less than 10%. It's less than 10%. I'm like, there shouldn't be a single mosque. You should be protesting. You know, you're Christians. We're at war with these people for the souls of everyone in this nation, if you want to call it that. You know, like, the atheists can at least be brought into the Christian thing. The Islamists will denounce you, accuse you of blasphemy, and in worst case scenario try and have you beheaded, you know, sort of thing. So these people are not your friends. You know, you would love to convert them. There's a very misquoted or a misunderstood passage, for instance, which says love your enemies, for instance. The word enemies does mean enemies. You love your enemies, which means you don't visit upon them the worst atrocities that they might have done to you. So, for instance, Islam has spent the last 70 years raping and murdering our people in our own homeland. We are not going to go, after we eject them, to Pakistan and rape and murder all of their women, for instance. That's not something we do. And that's an act of mercy. It's an act of forgiveness. It's an act of love. It's an act of not an eye for an eye, right? It doesn't matter that that there are other conditions and prices to be paid, but that's what that essentially means in its context, right? It doesn't mean love everyone and therefore you have no enemies, right? So it's a different idea. And I think the English being based on there's a reason I bring Christianity in it. I'm not trying to convert your audience or you or anything. It's more that the Christian ethos and moral code which the country is built on, once we lost our ethnic sense of self, we had all these Christian morals kicking around that were misinterpreted and and left in a vacuum because they couldn't be related to an actual sense of identity. I know I didn't have an English identity. I was known as English around the people that I grew up around, but I didn't have a sense of an English identity until like I was an adult, basically. And it only really came to a genesis because of my best friend is Irish, and the Irish and the English have a very, very storied history. And there are some very strong feelings, but they're all come from the Irish, and they see us as distinct people, and the English just don't sit there like, oh, we're basically the same. The Irish were basically the same. Same with the Scots. I remember when the Scottish referendum happened, forgive me, I'm in the South, obviously, but when the Scottish referendum happened, so many people were shocked and appalled that they would even ask the question, because surely we're all in it, you know, we love our Scottish brothers sort of thing. Because the sense of we've sort of absorbed a little bit of shared history. We see ourselves as the same as, I mean, the Welsh don't really exist. Sorry, Wales, they don't really exist in the mind of the English in the same way. But the Scottish and the Irish, who we've had more recent skirmishes with, so to speak, with the Troubles and the referendum for Scotland, mean that we sort of see them as kindred spirits, but we have yet to reclaim fully our sense of English identity. And this is what the English do. We used to be the main characters of the earth, where we ruled so much of it. And I don't want to go back to the point where we're invading other countries and taking them over or whatever. I actually think that the Age of Empire is a completely different thing. Having been to Africa myself, it's never been more apparent that the lines we drew on that map there bear almost no relation to what they were nice, pretty lines on a map to delineate countries that we marked out as territory. It had no bearing on the peoples who were living there, sort of like the Bantu nation, for instance, etc. And so when we withdrew, in large part, like, obviously they're all at war with each other and they've all got difficulties, and their governments don't work properly because they weren't formed, whereas England is an island nation. You can easily define the limits of it, and so we have a distinctive nature as a people with clear boundaries and borders, and it should be easy for us to have an ethnic identity, and yet for some reason it's been erased, some would say deliberately. Again, I'm rambling now. I'm off on a different.
No. It's all interesting. This sublimation or erasure of the English identity. Do you think that your parents had that? Do you think that your grandparents had that? I doubt it. So it's something that probably arrived with your generation or the one above it. What would you say?
I would say it's difficult for me to say for my family, because my father's side, for instance, leans much more into the Christian element than it does any ethnos. My mother's side, I would say, is more familial. And so what they reduced, again, they weren't particularly ethnically aware, but they were, certainly my grandfather was aware of his position as a person for the people. He was in the special branch of the police many years ago, and he used to train people and did a lot of sort of espionage training and stuff like that. So he was aware that Britain had enemies and needed to tail people and do spy work and stuff like that. So I would say that that's the case. But my parents' generation were sheltered a lot from that. They had no real need to. They were very middle class anyway. My father moved down from London, and my mother was always down here, and they haven't really had to develop that kind of consciousness, that kind of ethnic consciousness. My father still hasn't got it. My mother I've made considerably more based over the years, as she's deigned to learn more about the world, and it's been my pleasure to help her with that.
Well, but, and the arrival of diversity, I think, has changed everything. I think that window of time where...
Oh, my favourite anecdote for this
you couldn't have an identity is over and was short. Sorry, go.
My favourite anecdote about this is probably, my best friend, who is Irish father, Welsh mother, born in England. Sort of child of no nation. Is this my connection or is it yours? I hope it's just mine. Yeah, so my best friend visited. He was like, you know, you can't say these things, Mark. You can't talk about what's happening to the country. And then he went on a walk with his family in a seaside town in Kent, and came back, and he was like, they were just milling around, Mark. They're just milling around, speaking other languages and not doing anything, and there are so many of them. And sort of almost overnight became aware, and therefore is now in a position where he's not particularly politically engaged, but he knows what the problem is, so to speak. He knows that there's a large group of people taking advantage of our system, and they're from a faraway place, and they don't belong here. So... Yeah,
I think a lot of people have been jolted into making that realization over the last few years, especially this year. It really seems to have ramped up this year. Hold on a second. Let me just see if there was anything else I wanted to. Oh, yeah. There was a question that arose earlier. When you say that you quite regularly you go around your town and just chat to people and ask, and that's how you gauge where the normie is. Do any people ever say words to the effect that diversity is our strength?
In particular places, yes. So I make sure to put myself in a position to speak to as wide a range of people as possible. Everyone in the gym, way more base than average. People on the street, pensioners, tend to be much less based. Because they're living in their own little retirement world. I don't know what it is. Maybe they set in stone their viewpoint 40 years ago and they've never really been given a reason to depart from it. I wonder what the difference is between the people who are able to look after themselves versus those who've been put in the care homes, for instance, or who have that. There's a kind of grand veneration of the NHS, for instance, and diversity is obviously, the diversity rhetoric, I should say, is quite often connected to the functioning of our NHS, even though that's a myth. And then there's a working man's club, which I also frequent, which contains a mixture of people, and they tend to be realists, but they tend to be strongly opinioned, but they could go one way or the other. It's quite interesting. The diversity is our strength mantra is something, again, I notice creeped into the Christian sphere. There are like five or six churches in my local area. And one of them, they had like all these tenets from the Bible, and then they changed it one year, a couple of years ago, and they added the word diversity at the bottom. And I was like, that's interesting, isn't it? That's a... like, you know, there is neither Jew nor Greek is the phrase they'll use to justify that one, but that's not what that passage indicates in the modern sense. But a lot of churches, I find, are waking up as well to the fact that they go, we need to be really wary about false teaching. We need to be really wary about being led astray by evil things, because none of the Christians in this country that I know feel represented by any of the parties. They're not willing at this stage to admit there's enough of a crisis in this country that there should be Christian MPs who are overtly, explicitly Christian for Christian ideals, for instance. Again, regardless of where you stand on that, like that's a demographic. But they don't really see that. Where was I going with this?
Diversity is our strength.
Yeah, they reject that. And so they're then coming to question what is the true cost of liberalism and how liberal is the Bible really? And I will I am hoping that there will be a strong contingent, and there's always been a strong contingent at dissident events that I've attended, of young dissident Christians who have gone, wait a second, this is nothing like what I think the Bible teaches. This world that we're living in, which is run to alienate us from everything and everyone, and to expressly remove all of the obligations and bonds that we have with one another, and that makes me feel meaningless, and is also, it seems to be, not what Jesus was teaching. So again, you can take the religious element for what it is, but I think that the Christian youth are an interesting barometer for identifying this, because they already have a competing system, the Christian system, which is often aligned with liberalism in some ways, but is now starting to question that because it's being destroyed so completely by liberalism.
I think that the emergence this year of the UK meme is very interesting here, because it's not just mass immigration, although that's I would say 50% of it, but the other 50% is a sense of atomization, which results not just from the immigration, but from our own internal rot, such as things like the church cucking and transforming and progressivizing, and these social bonds dissolving. So you end up with a sort of awful wasteland, the remnants of, you know, some dotted around Victorian architecture, the remnants of 60s brutalism, and then 90s glass and steel, which is already going rotten. And it's just a nightmare hellscape in many British towns now. And so it even feels like a country that's spiritually torn apart and ruptured.
Yeah, if you want to take the spiritual dimension of the expression of a nation, it's an interesting one. If you consider the pre-digital age, the pre sort of death of manufacturing in this country, pre-war part of this, we have a very rich history. We have a very rich culinary history, interestingly, which is now denigrated sort of worldwide ad nauseum. We have, if you think about what it would take to build a building that would take 150 years, again, pre-industry, like large cranes and mechanization and stuff that we have now, you know, you look to what resources you have, and they say that sort of the restrictions that you face shape what you're building. So you've only got so much of a footprint, you've only got so much materials nearby, you can only transport particular materials. This is why, you know, you'll get a church, again, to keep things on track. There's a church and it's built out of local stone, and it was made by the local stonemasons who knew a particular style, and it was done in this way. And so it's got a kind of character of its own. And the community came together to make it because all the craftsmen in all the different types of craft that they needed to do would have been involved in that kind of a project, because it demanded so many resources from them, and there were only so many skilled laborers. Whereas now it's like, well, who can we import, because everyone can drive and everyone can fly and everyone can do this, and we're going to import, like, we've got this nuclear power station, okay, we're going to build this nuclear power station, and instead of building it in a way which is in keeping with the local side, with local style, as much as obviously there are safety requirements, here are the restrictions. We need to build these enormous towers, for instance, to get the steam run off or whatever. We're going to build this enormous tower, right? How can we decorate that? How can we make that fit? How can we put in place jobs for the local community? How can we do all that? No, we'll just get the Chinese in to build it as cheaply as possible after bidding on a government contract. We're going to import concrete from Morocco or something like that, because that's the cheapest place to get it, and quicklime from Malaysia. And isn't it wonderful? We've got this great global supply chain, and it's going to be built in the most monstrous, grey-faced, miserable way possible. And we don't know exactly how it works, because the Chinese made it, and they might have put in some back doors just in case they need to collapse our national grid. That attitude of global supply chains is like, we did it cheaply, guys, but no one cares about it. No one wants it there. It's probably more fraught with errors and more likely to collapse. And it's not taking advantage of global talent. It's bringing the bar down in so many different ways. And it's no longer expressing our culture. It's expressing expressly zero culture, as utilitarian as possible. And so there's no room to even work a cultural expression into such a project as that, right? Now, you could take something else and go, right, well, it's a nuclear power station. It's going to be ugly no matter what you do to it. But it doesn't matter what that project is. You know, it could be something like, I don't know.
Well, like the Edinburgh tram system, which was designed, yeah, exactly. It was done by Germans. I mean, and, you know, it's preferable to the Chinese, but still, why? Still. Why not Scottish? Why not Scottish people? I don't understand. What? It's crazy.
You've just reminded me of one of the greatest, things, which is like our British streetlight system, you know, the great ugly grey poles. And someone said, now imagine Trafalgar Square ringed by those. If you've been to Trafalgar Square, there are these great big old sort of where they used to hold oil lanterns, or at least they're designed to look like those. They're great big wrought iron things. There's the royal crest on the base plate of it. You know, it's the difference between the red phone booth in Britain and the BT cash point phone booth, you know, the ones I mean, where they're like, I think they come pre-graffitied, you know.
I'm old enough to remember the 80s, the British Telecom phone boxes, and I'm autistic enough to have a folder of images of phone boxes, so I can even illustrate this. But yeah, the everyone knows the red phone boxes from Britain, and here's an example. There we go, and that's one that's been subsequently repurposed. Oh, yeah. But anyway, the point is that it was replaced in the 80s by this kind of thing, and
that's exactly what I was describing. Yeah.
Yeah, and then in the 90s they became different again, but the point is it's shit. It's just not nice. It's not pleasant. It's utilitarian and soulless. But I'm sure it's cost effective.
Mm. And that's something again. As we've become a poorer nation, and make no bounds about it, we've become a poorer nation. Again, all those reasons that I mentioned earlier in the stream. If you've just tuned in. It's a good conversation where we talked about the fact that we've had all this capital flight from Britain, and that now the wealth is only really concentrating itself in London. We've got the same issue that the Republic of Ireland has, in a way, where the Republic of Ireland's GDP is so high that it should be a first world country, like a proper first world country. It is in some ways, and it isn't in others. But they had what was called Celtic Tiger over there, which is this huge building craze and so on, and they had a huge crash. And so suddenly you had these enormous houses which were half built, like selling for pennies in the middle of nowhere because the investment in Ireland wasn't going necessarily where they thought it would. And I remember the first time I went over there, and there was a taxi driver, and he was almost in tears, bless him, because we were driving to a place that he hadn't been in a while, and he could see cranes on the thing. He's like, I haven't seen cranes, you know, it's years ago, obviously. He said, I haven't seen cranes here in nearly 20 years, and yet we're building it now. And he was so proud, you know, the fact that we're getting off the ground and getting back up. But they used to say about Ireland, you know, it's a poor country, but it's a high GDP. So, and it is true that just because Google headquarters itself in Ireland for tax purposes doesn't mean that they invest in the local community. And we've got that issue. So people headquarter themselves in London, but it doesn't mean that they invest in our country. And at the same time, you've got huge capital flight from all these other sources that means that, again, we're just worse off per capita. And people like to talk to death about GDP and the fact that, yes, GDP and GDP per capita are two separate things and anything, and we'll sacrifice anything on the holy altar of GDP, as many Bamalians as you can fit in the country, when we've got a single person for every 5 foot of space in this country, then at least... then we'll have, you know, it doesn't matter that the quality of living and the GDP per capita is like 5 pence, but the fact that we've managed to get the national GDP is high enough that it's relevant. So that's obviously a good thing. And so I think GDP as a metric has been very dangerous for us, but they want to push GDP because it helps our borrowing limits so they can push us ever further into debt. What the solution is to that debt, I don't know yet. It's probably going to be some form of digital currency, but I'm not qualified enough in that to work out how that is exactly going to manifest. But I think when the sort of like there's a global economic reset, essentially, probably led by America, where because they'll want to do it in such a way that they retain control when you see China investing in the gold-backed yuan and stuff like that, and they're scared of BRICS economies. But they'll want to maintain the hegemony of the petrodollar in some way. They'll figure out some way to do it, and there'll be an American-backed digital currency, and then it'll go from there, and everyone else will adopt. But that being said, we're in a tough situation where we're a poor country, and we don't know it yet.
In amongst all of that, to get to one of the other things you wanted to talk about, in amongst all of that is this apparent surge in, well, ethnic consciousness on the part of the, we'll just say the English, because I think the Scots are a different story here. Rise in ethnic consciousness, and also perhaps pairing with that is a rise in the is a talk of remigration. That seems to have become a huge thing over the last year, and even in the mainstream now, and talk of mass deportations. I think we're even heading towards a situation where the political parties are having to compete with each other, and you sort of alluded to this earlier, compete with each other to offer a harder line on mass deportation. And of course, that doesn't mean they're going to do it, or that they're going to do it imminently, or that they want to do it. But it's nonetheless, it's a different world from 5 years ago, or even 2 years ago.
It's what we call the, if you're in a marketing space, you'd call it the choice architecture, right? It's like if you set up your membership program and you have a supporter tier for $1, and you have a tier with a slight benefit, let's say a private post or a video that's early or whatever, for $5, right? Then you can say, with a choice thing, or you can support me for as little as $1, and that immediately gets them to open the panel with all of the options on it. And the reality is that you don't just want $1 from that person, you'd quite like $5, and if they've got the money spare and they're more generous, you want the higher tiers from them. But the choice is it worth your time to take a look at the tiers on the basis that there's a $1 option? And that's a choice that someone has to make. And so what we've forced our politicians to do, as opposed to having a $5 tier, at which point you've immediately alienated a huge bunch of people who might not have looked and gone, oh, I quite like the idea of an early video, I'll get $5. So what the politicians are now in a position of is, what's the choice architecture here for the next general election? Labour looks like it's going down the toilet. We now have to directly compete with Reform, who's topping the polls out. And so you see the two very different approaches. The first is the Conservatives, who are trying to win back whatever, let's say, goodwill that they had from their premiership. You've got the Labour Party, who know they're screwed and so are trying to do as much damage as they can. Oh, sorry. Advance their agenda as much as they can before their inevitable demise, and then hope against hope that it makes enough of a positive impact on people's lives that suddenly everyone comes around and goes, oh, we were so wrong, Labour, we're so sorry, we'll love you forever, and the red wall is stronger than ever. And then the Tories, who are going, we need to get some goodwill, but they're so compromised that obviously they've put a Nigerian in charge of themselves, so that's not going to happen. The Greens have obviously gone the opposite way, and they've gone, right, well, we are so opposed to the direction of travel that Reform is going in, that we're going to take the opposite, the hard line. We're going to be even more hard line than Labour. And because Labour has disappointed so many people, there are going to be a number of those alienated people who go, well, Labour haven't done what we wanted. Maybe these guys will. And so that's where they've picked up their support, because I don't think Zach Polanski is organic in any way in terms of a voter support system. And then you've got Reform and whatever comes after Reform. You could talk to groups like UKIP, but UKIP are more... their time has come and gone. They existed in the run-up to 2016. They had a very particular purpose. I saw the absolute fallout and implosion of that party post-2016, and post-Farage and post-Gerard Batten and then post-Richard Brain and then back to Batten and all sorts. And now it's run by Nick Tanconi, who is what I would describe as a political polemicist. He knows how to get clicks, but it's all drama. It's all sort of a little bit, what's the word I would say? Like, again, it engages with a hyper-reality a little bit too much. He's not going to get anywhere leading...
Performative.
Performative. He's not going to get anywhere leading 200-person marches through Sheffield, you know, which is a lot of what he does. And then occasionally he gets in the news because he threw a Roman. I don't take that.
I think the word is grandstanding. I think that might be the word you were reaching for. But yeah, I agree. I think UKIP is done. I think that's over. It just seems like an obsolete brand at this point. It's like something from 10 years ago. Even though it was going quite, it was quite a thing up until about 2018, 19, and then it nosedived. So we've got this new environment, this new political climate, in which they're now talking about mass deportation. And it's still on the civic model where, well, we've got to get rid of these people because they're not paying taxes, or they're not, I don't know, they're not drinking enough tea or something. They're just not quite aligning with British culture. They're not becoming British enough. So it's got nothing to do with race. But everyone knows that it's a proxy for race. You'd have to be retarded to think it was anything else. But that can never be said, certainly not by mainstream politicians.
Not without a current understanding of race either, no, on a cultural level. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So the point is that a Nigerian or an Afghan is I think everyone instinctively knows that person. They might have been here for 50 years, but they're not us. They're not. I might be even be friends with them, but they're not my kind. Everyone knows that, and everyone feels it, and everyone knows that they are feeling it. So,
well, the true difficulty that we risk and that we're in the problem with at the moment is drawing allyship purely along ethnic lines, which is something which we might have to do, at least temporarily. But because, again, think of Britain in a place where we want it to be. You have a resurgent English identity within a strong United Kingdom, let's say, where the interests of the four major groups there are balanced. And then you have Britain making its foreign policy decisions and its foreign affairs decisions based on who it wants to ally itself with. So, for instance, we had this whole thing where we handed Hong Kong back to the Chinese, and then we had this deal where we would take people who were fleeing at that time riots in Hong Kong temporarily on a temporary basis. Just to be clear, I'm not going to get into it, but my view of the asylum system as a whole is that we should be out of the ECHR and have specific arrangements with specific countries based on our interests and how friendly we are with those countries, regardless of where they are. So, for instance, I wouldn't have a problem with a temporary resettlement scheme for a group of people from a given country with specific limits. And, oh, as soon as that country is back on its feet or considered to be a low danger level, you have to go back now. Also, it's exclusively women and children, for instance, right? Like, that's not a problem. For me, I don't really care about the color of their skin as long as there are limits on if they're here. Basically, limits on them there. I look actually to which country is it now? There's a country in the near the UAE. Its name escapes me now, but basically they have a system where they just go like, we have people here and they have no rights and they don't agitate politically. Foreigners don't agitate politically because they never have political power. They never have the right.
Singapore.
No,
it's Singapore, not Singapore, isn't it? No,
there's no. It's a kingdom. It's specifically a kingdom, but it's not Saudi either. But
Bahrain, Qatar, Oman, Kuwait.
Oman.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And it's just that they specifically have these things, and so when people go there to work, you know, they're obviously pulling from the diaspora around them, whereas we'd be pulling from the diaspora around us, hopefully. They just understand that, so you don't end up with people marching around saying free Palestine in their country, because they're never going to do anything, right? Like, they never have the ability to form a bloc, because what would be the point? So when people say, oh, you know, the Poles came and we fulfilled the work shortage that you had, aside from the fact that we could argue back and forth about wage suppression, we could argue back and forth about equivalencies in skill and stuff like that, I am not opposed to the idea that for specific projects, if you wanted to bring people in for something, if you literally couldn't source it, you'd have to put in place an infrastructure where you wanted to source local labour. But again, let's say that a technology had been developed abroad in another country and that particular team was an expert in that thing and you brought them in. I don't have a problem with that. But they're not going to be treated the same as citizens. Like, come on. Sorry, we're getting too far off the track here. We were talking about...
Remigration.
About remigration, which again is a very curious term because it's a sanitized term in a sense. It's an alternative term. It's not what we called, like, America's got a lot of baggage around the term deportation, and then that gets transferred across over here. So this term remigration, which has come out as like this thing which is distinct, this thing which doesn't just describe booting people's doors in and dragging them into the back of a van and then kicking them out of the country, but also encompasses a whole plethora of different policy decisions which make it uncomfortable to practice a different culture in this country or something which is contrary to our culture. So, for instance, the recognition of other national other international holidays, the recognition of other cultural practices, particularly demonstrated in our education system, particularly demonstrated in our streets, the idea that, like, London would hold Diwali celebration with lights and stuff throughout the city and so on. Completely alien. That needs to go. That needs to just be gone. That's not us. That's not ours. Representations of foreign cultures that have made their way, like the Whitechapel Station stuff where they've got it in Bengali or whatever.
Absurd.
That's gone.
Yeah,
you know, all of these things, ban halal slaughter in its entirety, you know, you can have it so that it's able to be imported even if you're concerned about foreign dignitaries and stuff like that. All you need to do is change the choice architecture from, is this too much trouble for me to arrive at, or is there a way for the British people to publicly benefit and profit off the decision of the foreigner to make this decision in their country, right? So, for instance, we would say it costs... again, I had an argument with a discussion with a Polish guy who said, I paid into the British tax system for 20 years nearly. And we worked it out, and he'd paid about £200,000 in tax, right? And then I said, yeah. And then you bought a house for £95,000 a decade ago, and you sold it for £250,000, and then you left the country. So essentially, you've been a net negative of £50,000 because you've taken that money out of our internal economy. It doesn't matter how much you've paid in tax to the state at that point. You're either net neutral or you're worse, right? It doesn't matter that you never used the NHS, that you were healthy and that you used local stuff, you've just taken £250,000 out of our economy. And you're the best case scenario, right? Like, you're different to a Somalian, right? Who's living with three wives and 16 children, half of whom are inbred, right? So that's a different situation. So making things like a remittance tax, which ensures that anyone who sends money abroad, because we're something like 16% of Pakistan's remittance-based GDP or something like that, 100% should be 100% tax. If you want to send a pound abroad, it's going to cost you a pound, right? Something like that. So that, you know, at least we get back, you know, back into our internal economy what you've just taken out of it. And because people aren't working abroad, and then, like, no Brit is going to Australia, working there, and then sending money home to his family who's impoverished in, like, Bristol. Like, it doesn't work that way. It's not how it goes. So it's not like we've got this big inflow that way. As I say, ban the building of mosques. It's just not enough. It's just not part of our cultural or history, and it's not something that we want here. You repurpose that. You take out the diversity targets out of everything. All of the what do they call them? ESG targets for business, etc. You ensure that almost all government contracts go to a British-owned firm and stuff like that. And again, it doesn't matter. I renationalize a whole bunch of stuff and provide benefits again for citizens. So, and charge, you know, in the same way that we charge foreigners more for university, they should be charged more for tourists who come here should be charged more to use the train, right? Like, if you do that, we shouldn't be subsidizing Italy's rail system by having that owned partially by Italy and France. Like, that just shouldn't be a thing. Again, so remigration as a term is not just encompassing the deportation of people who shouldn't be here. It's not just the deportation of illegals. It's the whole cultural atmosphere, the whole rigging of the system in favor of the foreigner that needs to go. It's remigrating that and all of the aspects of it. And therefore turning them back towards native first, indigenous first, rejecting the UN and the EU's perspective that there are no indigenous European peoples except the Sami. You know, we reject that entirely and say, actually, we've been here for, you know, my family's been here for thousands of years and will hopefully continue to be here for thousands more. And we're worthy of consideration. Thank you very much. And we will assert that.
Yeah. So there are a whole plethora of things that we could be doing and could start doing at any moment that would incentivize people to basically bugger off.
Self-deportation.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so with that said, I think we should get on to another topic, which you wanted to talk about, and I think that people will want to hear about, which is basket weaving, and what it is, how it started. Yeah, I haven't had people on to talk about basket weaving yet on Millennial. You're the first one who's going to talk about it in detail. It's been mentioned here and there for the last couple of years, but I think it's time that we hear about it in more detail. So Hope Not Hate think that you're behind it. You can set the record straight on that to whatever degree you want to. Just I think more relevant is to talk about it in itself and why people might want to get involved.
Sure. So yes, according to Hope Not Hate, I may as well be the Shadow Führer of England, setting up the largest, what they would describe as a right-wing sort of nutcase group in Britain. Apparently we're activists as well.
The fruitcake Führer, something like that.
Something like that, you know. Basket weaving, despite the name, the name itself was coined on an unpopular opinion stream years and years ago, where we were talking about what we should do. This is an ongoing conversation that me and various other guests on Academic Agent Stream had talked about in terms of, like, well, what does actual opposition mean? What does actual counter-elite mean? What does an actual network of tens look like? How do we identify people? How do, you know, who's going to lead this thing? Who's going to be a vanguard? Who's going to be waiting in the wings? And one of the things which came out of this that was close to my heart was the atomization of people online and this sort of idea of being terminally online. And having found community, shall we say, online, but with a whole bunch of people who you've either never met in real life, rarely meet in real life, can't really depend upon, might be able to get you to chuck you a fiver or whatever if you're desperately in need, but not everyone is fortunate enough or to be well placed to have a network of simps sending in super chats every week like us to get keep us afloat.
I thought you were going to say like an OnlyFans model, not like us. No.
But the parasocial relationship is basically what I'm getting at, right? Like there's a parasocial relationship between any audience and any creator, any podcaster, any whatever. And there's a parasocial relationship between people online, but it's less pronounced. You know, it builds in fandoms around various things. And it's no less true in the political sphere as it is for your favorite video game or a TV show. And I just thought there are a lot of these people and they're being increasingly radicalized and struggling online. And I would really like to do something about that. Now, fortunately, a group called Beowulf had already stepped in and created a Discord server and an infrastructure for basket weavers off the back of the chats which have been going on between the various people and academic agent in that space. And I gave a talk at the Shieldings conference in 2021, I want to say, I think it was. It's you can find it on my YouTube channel, which is not so obvious on YouTube, called Finding Authenticity in a World of Abstractions, or something to that effect. And I talked for about 40 minutes about how things have become less real. Everything's become more abstracted. Every single interaction that we have is now viewed through the lens of all these different other factors. You know, you're not just friends with someone, and the highest level of abstraction is you're in two different industries, or one of you likes to go quad biking and the other likes fishing. You know, like that was the level of abstraction. Now we're in a place where all of our finances are abstracted, all of our media entertainment is abstracted, all of our, like, people barely interact with the real world, and the Basket Weavers initiative is a chance and a hope that people will find more meaning doing real things in the real world. So basket weaving was supposed to encompass not just meeting up. It was never explicitly an activist thing, but it was more like, okay, the world is crap, your life is crap, and you're struggling for meaning here. So, and you feel completely alone. Well, how can we, as a group of people, help with that? And the way we decided to do that was we could put you in touch, essentially, by providing a space for you to get in touch with people in your local area. And then you could meet up and you're going to be friends with some of them and you're not going to be friends with others of them, and that's fine. And you're going to be self-motivated and self-started. And that will mean that you can do that. But I wanted to find someone who you could sleep on their sofa if you got kicked out. At that time, cancellation was a much bigger concern. So if you lost your job, like you needed people to rely on, then at the very least you had a support network that was there. If you were rejected by your family because you'd been called a racist or whatever, there were people you could go to that weren't just like some anonymous guys called MILF Hunter 69 in your local Discord server, you know, who you're like, oh, MILFy, I've had such a difficult week. You know, my parents have kicked me out. I lost my job. My girlfriend left me. And he goes, tough break, man. Keck. That's not quite the level of support that you're after. What you're after is someone who's a true friend, and especially for the terminally online types who perhaps are very poorly socialized as well, Basket Weavers is an outlet which allowed people to test that out. So even if you weren't able to form a really strong friendship with someone at a Basket Weavers meeting, then you're at least practicing social interaction in a way which is going to benefit you in other areas of your life, you know, in a work setting. It's going to help you manage your coworkers, be able to articulate your ideas better so that your family isn't as alienated from you, so that you can understand that. One of the big things that people kept saying to me at events was, oh, in the Q&A, you asked a question, and it was exactly what I was thinking, but I couldn't articulate it, right? And part of the reason I can articulate that is I have a network of really good people who I talk about these ideas with all the time. And so I'm able to articulate it pretty well. My thought process is there. But if you're someone who doesn't have that, or, you know, not to toot my own horn, right? But like, if you're someone who's a little bit, you struggle a bit with the intelligence aspect, then you need people to be able to make these arguments for you, or for you to be able to function. So you have to cheat a little bit, essentially. And the way we do that is by pulling together. So Basket Weavers was everything from a pub meetup to attending a skills class for something that you wanted to learn, but like had no one to go with or didn't feel brave enough to do, you know. So we have like a Basket Weavers reading club, like a Tolkien appreciation society from the Basket Weavers for like giga Tolkien nerds, the guys who have like a bowling league, guys who go and attend like whatever lectures are coming out of like Dissident Minds for events and stuff like that. And then you become a block in and of yourself. And I was very fortunate to be living in London, and I started the London Basket Weavers. And when I first started it, I set up one event and one guy turned up. We went for a walk in Epping over a couple of hours, and we had a lovely chat, and we came back and we posted about it in the Discord and went from there. And I kept on hammering it day after day. We're going to do this event. And I was very adamant that if you are someone who felt like you wanted to be a leader or someone who was of importance in this new thing that we were doing, don't be disparaged by the numbers who turn up. Pick something that you already want to do and do it, and then allow other people to come in and join. And do that for like 4 weeks and see what turns up. And you'll probably be surprised. Now, obviously, London, big pull to pull from it, was easier for me in that sense to do it. But I did get us up to about 35, 40 people who were attending, at which point it was out of my hands, really. I didn't have to manage anything. You had like guys who were like, oh, I'm the guy who puts together the schedule for like the next 4 weeks. And oh, I'm not going to attend on the Tuesday, but there's a Friday and a Saturday event, and I'm going to come to one of those. So you wouldn't normally have like 40 people turn up to one event. But what you'd have is sort of between 15 and 20 people who turn up to any given event, and you'd always be happy to see them. And now they run, as I say, like probably like 10 to 15 events a month. And there's always something for anyone there. And they're all pretty good friends, and they're all pretty friendly. And the lowest bar to entry is the pub meetup. And then the highest bar to entry is something you've got to pay for. But it's never out of anyone's means, you know. And if anyone felt like they couldn't afford to pay for something, like I know half the guys there would probably chip in a couple of quid and pay for that extra ticket, you know, together. And so that's what I wanted. And there were a few bars that I wanted to clear for the Basket Weavers. One was I wanted people to stop referring to each other by their Discord handles and start referring to each other by name, which met some success in some cases and not in others, because if you have new people come in, they go, oh, this guy's, his name's Nomad, you know, like, because I know him as Nomad, because they're all organizing that way. So that stuck around. But there are guys who changed their Discord handles to their real names and stuff like that, or at least an approximation, so that they were easily identifiable. And that was great. And there are some people, there we had a couple of members I know who got married as a result of meeting at the Basket Weavers, which was really, really special to me. They came up and they were engaged. I was like, you know, this thing that I put
together. That's amazing, isn't it? I've had once or twice, I've had a similar thing where people will meet in my Telegram group and MW Public, for anyone interested. And they get engaged, and on at least one occasion that I know of, they've had kids. It's also happened with my YouTube channel back in the day. There's at least one family that they met in the comment threads under my video. And it's a weird feeling, isn't it, to think that child exists because of me. Someone else's kid wouldn't exist if I hadn't done this. I mean, that's an astonishing thought, that an entire life wouldn't have happened.
I'm always intensely grateful to the network of people around me who have facilitated and helped and kept up the infrastructure. And like, as I say, if the Beowulf guys, who do a lot of work on Distant Right, to be clear, hadn't set up the space for us to be in, that would have been a huge barrier to starting what I wanted to start. The obviously the people who turned up week after week and made it a friendly place for people to meet of both sexes is obviously a huge boon. And so I'm intensely grateful for everyone. And whenever I'm beam with pride whenever anyone turns up and they go, "Oh, you're that guy. You're the basket weavers guy." Oh, I know that. Even more so, I'm even prouder when they turn up and I go, they're talking about the basket weavers and they have no idea who I am. You know, that's even more, because then the idea is much bigger than me. You know, it's not just a cult of personality that I help put something together. It's nice to be recognized, but because we're all slightly narcissistic in our own way. But the fact that it grows beyond the self is such a wonderful thing. And I'd encourage anyone who's even vaguely interested in such a thing to head to basketweavers.net and see what's around in your area, because you might be surprised. Because there's like 3,000 plus members now globally, a lot in America, a lot in the UK, but there's places, there's like one in South Africa, there's like one in Japan. It's bizarre, you know, like, I don't know how they've ended up in this particular sphere, but they are. And there you go.
Amazing. In order to keep it friendly and convivial, I imagine you've had to exclude some people as well along the way. Is that part of it?
I mean, there is a vetting system to join. Anyone who's exclusively LARPing, shall we say, or like clearly what we would call too much of a shitlord, is going to be excluded. I'm sorry, but we're after serious people at the end of the day who know what they're after, basically. The Discord space and all of the basket weaving spaces are very utilitarian in their makeup as well. You know, you're not going to find text channels full of memes and stuff to exploit. You are going to find a space which says, post about your meetup, explain who you are, sort of thing, and what you want to do. And the mods and the chief weaver in there, because every meeting is called a weave, is are there to help you in your mission to arrange a meetup in your local area.
If I think that's a good idea. See, so, that's a really good point, that I and other people should take note of this. Everything should have a purpose and a remit, or a point. And when you create an online space, because I remember doing that, I made this mistake. I learned this the hard way. And you create an online space, like a Skype group, for example, or a Telegram group, and then people start milling around, and then they wonder what the purpose is and what the point is. And if there isn't one, an explicit one, then first of all, they start just falling out with each other. But also, everyone gets demoralized because it's diluted. Dissipates. And I think it's fine. Like my Telegram group remains just a place for chatting. But I think if it were a place for doing X specifically, then I've got groups that have a specific purpose, and I don't allow idle chatting in there because that dilutes the purpose of the group. I think it's focus is important, and it just aids morale.
we were very explicit that one, we didn't want the space to become the very thing that I was talking about in that talk, which is an atomized space, a fandom, an online community where people felt comfortable just being without actually ever meeting these people. We thought that was counterproductive. And then we were also very keen that it was never going to be an activism space, specifically because then it could never be co-opted, could never be corrupted, could never be bought off. And yeah, that was the goal, was facilitate these meetups. They're self-selecting, they're self-excluding. You have to do that. And I had a mind to that in a broader sense of, it's good to identify some emergent leaders out of that who might be useful people to know long term. And it hasn't really turned into that. There have been people who've been influential in that space, but like they're well fitted to that space, and that's good, rather than anything more expansive than that. So I think keeping it simple, keeping the rationale for it simple, and then keeping it utilitarian has made it much more functional than a lot of these projects end up being, where they spiral out of control, or they don't know what they're meant to be, or there are conflicting visions. Whereas we've tried to keep the vision as clean as possible, and as simple as possible, and therefore have it work. Now, a lot of people tell me as well, I applied to the Basket Weavers and I got rejected. Now, if you have an issue with that, then bw.net Twitter account is your go-to for account queries and stuff like that. But also, it's entirely staffed by volunteers. So it takes a while to work through a backlog of applications and stuff like that. So don't be disheartened. Feel free to press the Twitter team to about your application, so you know where it is in the pipeline or whatever. Because I know that communication is a bit of an issue for us at the moment. But it's been going for 4 years, and it's stronger than it's ever been, and it's great. I think it's a really good initiative. So, yeah.
Okay. All right. Excellent. Well, let's leave it there. Oh, I did forget about the super chats. I mustn't do that. hold on a second. There's only one, and it's from Styx. Sent me here, Styx. I doubt that. And he says, thanks for putting this on this year, Woz. Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure and a privilege each year to do Millennial. Okay, well, this has been we talked for ages about the state of Britain and various political issues. Perhaps we should have opened on the Basket Weavers, because that's for a lot of people will want to hear about. But we've covered it, and we've covered it in detail, and I think it obviously is an idea that works. So there's no need for me to say it sounds like a good idea. It clearly is a good idea, and so yeah, I would just encourage people to follow your advice. Basketweavers.net, is that correct?
That's the one.
Right. Okay. Sorry, to be precise, with a hyphen or not?
No hyphen. All one word.
No hyphen. Right, I think I've got it in the description that people will no doubt find it themselves. Okay, excellent. Well, thank you for this appearance on Millennial. I think it's gone very well. Okay, I'll be back in about 10-15 minutes with the next interview. But in the meantime, Mark Houghton, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
My pleasure. Thank you, Wes.
All right.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.